This is a sensitive topic. I recall years ago the MIDS had me down to the Naval Academy to address a topic called sex in the single mid. And my opening remark to them was, gentlemen, there is no sex for the single mid. Sort of made it a classic for them. But since then, I've given an awful lot of thought to it. And what I'd like to do is share with you my philosophy on the subject of dating and courting, because sex is, and you just have to learn how to make peace with it, and then not only how to make peace with it, but how to handle it, and all the associated drives. Now, I'd like to make clear at the outset that this is my philosophy, and I'm well aware that each of you sitting out there tonight has your philosophy, and you're committed to it, and you're going to live it out. And I'm not naive enough to think that I can persuade you through force of argument tonight to embrace my philosophy, assuming mine's the correct one. So, as we go along, there'll be some thoughts that I'll share that will probably stroke you in the right way, in the way of your prejudices, and you'll like those. And then there'll probably be a couple of thoughts that I'll share that'll rub your hair the wrong way, and you won't like those. And what you'll do then will probably be to consolidate your defenses, and your mind will race, and you'll say, yes, but, yes, but, yes, but, yes, but. And while you're doing that, you're not listening, and you're not hearing what I'm saying. So my plea is to just sort of relax and listen to what I say. And then when we break up and we leave and you go back to the campus there, think about it. Run it through your mind day after day after day after day and sift it. And throw away that which you think is chaff, and then that which you think has the seeds of life, apply it to your philosophy. Now, what is my authority? What are the credentials that I have? I strongly suspect that I've talked personally, nose to nose, with at least 1,000 men and women of your age in the years that I've been involved, both in the ministry and as an officer and a NCO in the Marine Corps. From the time I left that boys' farm, I've been involved with your age group ever since. And your age group has one driving concern. The same driving concern that I was had at your age. So naturally, that's all we talked about. When I lived in the barracks, when I lived in the BOQ, when I was aboard ship, when I was overseas, back in the States, in the business community, in my neighborhood, men and women of your age have one primary concern. And that's the topic we're going to address tonight. So, I'm not the authority, but boy, I am an authority. And as I've read some of these other nitwits, I think I'm a pretty good authority. So, now a lot of what I'm going to say is going to be Lewisology. Because as I've gone through the Bible in the concordance, or as I've gone through Knave's Topical Bible or through many other concordances, I cannot find one listing under the heading dating or under the heading courting. So my little philosophy is Bible-based, but a whole lot of it's Lewisology. Now, I think as we go through, you'll realize that a lot of it does make sense. But it didn't come down from heaven on a sheet, if you remember that illustration in the Bible. Remember Peter and Simon the Tanner's house, and he had this little deal with a sheet come down. Well, I didn't get this stuff on a sheet. I got it through study and application, etc. So I'm going to start from this book. If there's one thing that book teaches me, and teaches you as you study it, right from the beginning, is that man and woman are created in the image of God. The Imago Dei, in the image of God. And because of that, man and woman is worthwhile, of unbelievable value, worthy of respect and honor, irrespective of how they look or behave. How many of you have seen the movie playing in town called The Elephant Man? Boy, now, if that doesn't come through in that flick, and that is that people didn't treat him as an object of worth and value. I watched that last night, and it really got to me. I'd read the book a long time ago. But to realize that movie depicts, if nothing else, man looks on the outward appearance and then treats people as things. And God looks on the heart. Because man is more than just an outward appearance. He's a heart, a soul. But so the Bible teaches us that. That was verified at the cross of Christ. And the cross teaches me two things. It teaches me two things about God, in that He loves man and judges sin. And then it says to me, with respect to man, that man is valuable but fallen. And as I look at each of you, I'm always in tension. You look so good, but you are so rotten. Just like me. I can look so good, but I'm so wicked. Born again, in the family of God, indwelt by the Spirit of God, but I've got an evil nature and I'm wicked. And I have to keep those two things in view as I think through my philosophy of life, of dating, of courting, etc. The Bible also then teaches me that my conduct must be Christ-like. How many of you are memorizing Scripture? All right. Now, how many of you have memorized 1 John 2:6? Who has memorized 1 John 2:6 besides Becky? Okay, why don't you write that one down as a future memory verse. He that saith he abideth in him ought himself also so to walk, even as he walked. Christ-like conduct is to be our norm. Now, who could give us the golden rule? Some brave soul, quote the golden rule. Good night, no one? Oh, come on. Surely Air Force cadets can quote the Golden Rule without having read the Bible? Good. Where's that found? Matthew what? What part of Matthew? Sermon on the Mount. And it's interesting that when Matthew said that, or when the Lord said it, Matthew recorded it, it says, as you would have others do unto you, even so do you unto them. So it makes no difference how they treat you. You should treat them as you would have them treat you. And that's very important as we consider this issue of dating and courting. The worth of the individual, how we should treat them. Now, I don't want to endorse dating tonight. Nor do I want to encourage it. Nor do I want to discourage it. That's extremely difficult for me because I'm an intense individual. Whatever opinions or convictions I hold them intensely. So I tend to come on real strong on things. But I would like to come across on this thing relatively neutral. If you want to date, terrific. If you don't want to date, terrific. At least know why you're going to date or why you're not going to date. And I would like to call it pre-courtship dating. And I want to differentiate between the two as we go along. Now I've got three reasons why I want you to consider the material. And the first one is for survival. For you. I want you to survive. Secondly, I want you to be able to minister to the men and women around you so that they can survive. And then thirdly, most of you are going to be moms and dads one day. And you're going to have kids. And I hope you're going to be ready to instruct your kids in this area. Because a lot of us grew up without any instruction from mom and dad. We learned it the wrong place. We learned it in restrooms, on the walls, and in little conversations in the locker rooms or whatever. We learned it the wrong place. So I would hope that you would think through now, early on, before you're at the place where you have to instruct your own kids. So I want you to survive. I want you to be able to share with those around you. And then I want you to start thinking now so that you're prepared for the day when you're a mom and a dad and you've got your preteens sitting out there and they're getting ready and their hormones are just running wild. And you want to be prepared because prior preparation prevents poor performance. All right. Why do you date? Let me share now with these folk that I've been talking with some of the reasons they've given me. We'll rush through them quickly so we'll have time for questions. Beautiful. Hit the wrong one.
The bar.
Peer pressure. Generally, we date because of peer pressure. Our friends say to us, who are you going with? And it's inferred that you ought to be going with someone. And if you're not, you're a nerd. You're not normal. You got to be going with someone. Because everybody is. And if I didn't, I'd be a freak. And I sure don't want to be a freak. So usually then we succumb under that kind of pressure. We go with someone. Second reason we generally date is because of parental pressure. Usually mom or dad says to you, who are you going with? Or, you're not going with someone yet? I shared this illustration a couple weeks ago in Germany, or in Switzerland, with some of our military troops there. Normally it's the girls who get this kind of pressure from mom and dad. But when we were done and I was standing around talking to a few troops, one young guy came up to me and says, you know, Bob, he said, my dad just called me last week. My dad's been calling me monthly. And all my dad is interested in is, who am I going with? Surely there ought to be a nice American girl over there in the military you could go with. And if there's not, maybe there's a nice German girl you could go with. Now, do you know why his dad is so concerned? And often why your mom and dad is concerned? They want to be reassured that you are normal. Because as they look around them, men and women your age are going with somebody. And if you're not, maybe you're not normal. Maybe there's something wrong with you. And then there's another reason. They want to be able to reassure their friends and relatives that you're normal. So they really are concerned for you. And then at a younger age, maybe not so much at your age, but at a younger age, mom and dad are often concerned that they miss the boat in giving you a healthy sex education. And they're sure hoping that through a dating relationship, you begin to pick up the loose ends that they didn't tie together. That's a sad reason for it, but it's often the case. Third reason we date is for security needs. Now, I came out of a broken home, a wretched background, a home in which there wasn't any comfort or love and a lot of other things. So I was a setup for dating. Because, you know, we all need comfort. We need someone to reach out and touch us and stroke us and make us feel warm. We need someone to love us, to accept us, someone with whom we can count on consistency, i.e., she's always there or he's always there. I can rely on that stability. And if I don't get it at home, I'm a setup to go looking for it somewhere else. And then we all need to be essential, to have a sense of essentiality. And you know, usually you hear it this way when I talk, and they'll say, well, you know, Bob, she really needs me. I couldn't break it off right now because she needs me. I'm essential to her. Or vice versa. Now, here's a little Lewisology. Oftentimes when kids are young and they don't get the security needs they need in a home, they start to suck their thumb or stroke a little blanket. Mom and dad, being reluctant to minister to that area in their life, i.e. to provide those securities, just let it go. Well, now you and I know how grotesque it is to see a teenager walking through school or, you know, a freshman on campus sucking their thumb, you know, and twirling their hair. It's kind of freaky. Or to walk into class with a little blanket and sort of stroke it, you know how they do? So we don't do that. But you know what we do instead? We go steady. We get a girl or a guy and we use him or her to meet those needs. And so we're sucking the thumb or we're stroking the blanket. I was sharing this thought on a campus in the Northeast here last winter. And then when we finished, we had a little question and answer time, and a bunch of them came up front. We were all hassling over this stuff, and this one girl began to jerk my chain just royally. And the guy sitting next to her was just sort of listening, you know, and listening to her and looking at me and listening to her and looking at me, you know, and in front of him went, hey, wait a minute, he said. I knew that guy you're going with, And that relationship you have with him is just like sucking your thumb. He's got it right on. See, we know that. Now, the Bible says that human beings are of infinite worth, and it's wrong to use them that way. It's wrong to use them in a dating relationship like that to meet those kind of needs. The next reason I'll just touch on lightly because it's historical now, and that's the commercial... Oh, I'm sorry. I got ahead of myself. Ego gratification. Let me hit on that one. The desire to conquer and control. And it's inherent in all of us. We want to control the opposite sex. Get on top and then have control. So guys got this big macho image and they want to have all the girls on the string. Girls are just like guys. They're a little more sweeter about it, a little subtler. But it's the same thing. In fact, now this is Lewisology. Girls are far stronger than men. In fact, the only way that men can really conquer women is by violent, forcible rape. In every other situation, women conquer men. Men just don't realize it. Women are so smooth, they make you think that you've conquered. So there's this drive that women have, and they must learn to harness it, to get it under control for the good of mankind. In the kingdom of God and outside the kingdom of God. That's why it's so important. And I'll touch on a few things here in a little bit in this area. But there's this drive to conquer. And it must be controlled. Now the next one I've got is commercial pressure. And that happened a long time ago when the industry realized that if they would just promote dating, it opened up a whole new market for cars, for clothes, for things. And then the last one is shopping for a partner. We date because we're hunting for a partner. Well, should we date? I'll leave that up to you. But if you're going to date to satisfy any of those areas, I would suggest your dating's wrong. Shouldn't date for those reasons. Also, if your dating is really courting, then you shouldn't date either. You need to redefine. Now, as I looked in Webster, Webster said that dating was an appointment with someone to do something, generally with someone of the opposite sex. So let me put it this way in my definition. And that is dating is going somewhere to do something. It's an activity or an event. Dating is going somewhere to do something. What would be the objectives in dating that I would suggest? Primarily, fun. Just have fun. The objective is not the development of an intense interpersonal relationship. That's courting. Dating is to just have fun. Another objective might be to be with your friends and being with your friends in larger circle of friends. And in that context, the continued growth in social grace and poise. It's wrong to date to satisfy this ego gratification. It's wrong to date just to be involved in sexual experimentation. To familiarize yourself, so to speak. And it's wrong to date pre-courtship in a courtship relationship. Let me make that clear. I'd suggest you we have dating and we have courting. Now, if we make our dating courting, we're going to get ourselves into hot water in terms of the relationship. I'll clear that up in a minute. Let me say that there are some costs that are associated with dating. Some are real obvious. I call the obvious ones the open costs. Time, money, and emotional energy. It's going to cost you time. Can't date someone without spending some time. It's going to cost you some bucks, generally. And then it's going to cost you emotional energy. Because when you're with people, it costs you emotional energy. But there are some hidden costs, indirect. These generally are paid when you're involved in a steady relationship. Now, generally, let me say some of these I'm going to give you are more applicable in the early teen years when you're in high school. But I want to share them with you to get them in your thinking so that you can run them through your grid in setting up your own philosophy of dating for later. And the first one is too much peer input. And here's where you generally allow the peers to interpret life for one another, rather than the parent or those who are older. And then in this same situation, we end up with what I'd like to call peer snaring. And that's because of this peer contact, you end up getting trapped in a relationship that you don't know how to get out of. And this so often happens in those early teen years. When you end up in with a relationship with a guy or a gal in high school and you just don't know how to get out of it. You've never been there before. You never had your daddy sit you down and say, now look, there are 50 ways to live your lover and you can start going through those and pick any one of the 50. And I had to say that to my son and I had to say that to my daughter over and over again. There are 50 ways to leave your lover and cut it off here and cut it off here and cut it off here. You're going to get trapped. Because of these two, too much peer input and peer snaring, you generally end up with stunted emotional growth. Let me give you an illustration I use on my kids. Still do. I only allow my kids 2 nights a week away from me when they're in high school, growing up. And I don't care who it's with, whether it's with the church, high school groups, or whatever, they only get 2 nights a week away from me. I'm responsible for their development until they launch out of my home. And when they graduate from high school, I launch them out. But before then, I have to have the overriding influence in their life. So my boy Eric says to me when we negotiated this deal, he says, well, Dad, now old so-and-so is a believer. He loves God and he's involved in the ministry and all these other things. Why can't I have more nights a week with him? I said, son, it's simple. He's only 25. He's only 25. I'm almost 40 years old then. I says, and I want to make sure that I have the overriding influence in your head. He's got a 25-year-old view of life, and that's fine for a 25-year-old. But I got a 40-year-old view of life, and I want to make sure that I balance it out. Because I'm responsible for you in the way you view life and relationships until you leave my home at 18. And then, boy, you're on your own. My responsibility is to get you ready, and then I launch you out at that point. And so here I want to make sure that his emotional growth, his psychological growth, etc., is healthy. Another hidden cost is sexual involvement. And in these intense dating relationships we have in our country today, boy, we see it violated right there. Now, there are two things you have to deal with. If you get involved sexually with someone else, you have to deal with the emotional trauma and the associated scars. And they're heavy. And then you have to deal, especially if you have a physical relationship, sexual, with someone, and you're not married, then you have to deal with the mystical union that's affected between you and that individual, and which remains until you die. You go to bed with someone, you are united mystically with that person for the rest of your natural life. And that union is never broken. And let me hammer that one home. It is never, never, never broken. I was going over this topic with some guys in a jock dorm at one of the universities out east. There were about 50 of them in there, and we'd had a little meeting, and I was making this point. And this one guy sat back, and he just smirked at me and smiled. And I finished my point, moved on. When it was over with, and I walked on back and sat next to him. I said, say, I noticed you had a smile pass across your face when we were talking, when I was talking on this particular point. I said, could I ask you if you had a particular thought? Go ahead, he said. I said, did you think, you know, I've had many of those relationships, and it doesn't bother me a bit. It doesn't bother me a bit. He said, yeah, that's right. Doesn't bother me a bit, man. I'm enjoying it. And I said, well, son, I got good news for you. God's going to get you. God says that you reap what you sow. And when you have these many mystical unions, you are fragmenting yourself. And you can't get away with it. And God's going to make you pay for it. Paul says, "Know ye not that he which is joined to an harlot is one flesh? For two, saith he, is one flesh." You're stuck with it. Now, God designed it in terms of his goodness to man for your benefit, to help you in the marriage relationship. Because, boy, if marriage is one thing, it is hard work. Working on an in-depth interpersonal relationship over the course of years is hard work. You could put all the romance you want into it. It is still hard work. So the Lord, in wanting to help us with that, gives us this one flesh relationship where he welds us together. But it's meant to be only in the bonds of that responsible relationship and not promiscuous. But one of the hidden costs of dating is that. And then the last one let me share would be marriage to the wrong partner. Because you get sexually involved and you have to get married, you could end up with the wrong partner. And you say, "Bob, is it possible for a believer to end up with the wrong partner?" And I say, "You bet. Is it ever?" Because you can have in this life, in the kingdom of God, exactly what you want. And you set your mind on it and God will say, "You can have it. Just go get it." And you can end up with the wrong partner. Believers can. And it's been my experience in these years that believers are just as fouled up in this area as the pagans are. Believers are having just as many problems as the unregenerate are. It ought not so to be. Now, how do you date? How do you go about it? First off, again, let me mention that you should have objectives that are fun-oriented. If you're going to date, make sure your objective is fun. And then in that context, make certain your expectation level is in harmony with that objective. That when you go out, you don't expect to have more than fun. Just fun. And then thirdly, let me suggest that you have some guidelines. Number one, generally never date one-on-one. Make your dating in the context of a group. Preferably odd. Odd number, that is. This will preclude the possibility of pairing up. We are animals who pair up. Human animals who pair up. So I suggest having an odd-numbered group. 3, 5, 7, 9. And let me toss in here, make certain that in the context of that group, those of your philosophy outnumber those of an alien philosophy. Let me say that again. In the group, three of you, two of you think your way, and the third one thinks another way. Could think your way, but at least no more than one that doesn't think your way. That your philosophy always outnumbers the other. Second guideline, generally never twice in succession with the same group composition. Especially if Mr. Tall, Tan, and Terrific's in that group, the one that you're really interested in. Or whatever illustration you want to use for the girl. Make sure that he or she isn't in that same group. For your own good. My thought behind that is you need breathing space or thinking time away from that person that has such an influence on you. So don't date them twice in succession. The third guideline is generally never longer than 3 to 5 hours. Keep it short. Again, so that you can get away and think about what went on. A fourth little guideline here has to do with having an accountability relationship with someone who, at the conclusion of the date, you know he or she is going to ask you how you behaved. What did you say? What did you do? Where did you go? And again, it's just for your own survival. Now, in the context of those guidelines, let me suggest some safeguards. And the first safeguard I want to suggest is hands off. And by that I mean no skin on skin, no licky face, no draping yourself around one another. Always remember we were clothes, not people. Now, I'm hard-nosed on this issue of petting for many reasons. Number one, the Bible says to me, she's your sister, mister. And you don't pet with your sister, do you? If you do, there's something wrong with you. So if you don't pet with your sister, then you don't pet with her either. You keep your hands off. Secondly, those bodily drives that you and I have are really powerful, and they are really hard to control. And the more you allow them to get revved up, the harder they are to control. And the guys say to me, well, Bob, I got it under control all the time. No problem. No problem at all. Anytime I want, I can just cut it off like that. I think, sure you can. When I flew, almost all the birds that I flew had a fail-safe feature such that if I ever had a linkage failure in my throttle control, my throttle would go to almost full power. So I could execute a wave off, do a number of other things, but I would have full power. And it happens that way when you get that old drive that you have all cranked up, and you think you've got it under control, and then all of a sudden, whammo, the linkage fails. And you don't have it under control, and it's gone to full power, and it's too late. And you can't shut it off. So the safest thing is, don't crank it up until you ought to crank it up. And we'll get to when should you crank it up. All right. Another reason I'm so strong on this is the subtle temptation to expect the girl to repay your interest with physical favors, or for the girl to think that she ought to repay your interest with physical favors. And that happens today. Well, man, he was nice enough to take me out. I ought to let him put his arm around me, and I ought to let him do this, and I ought to let him do that. And then it gets out of hand. Our culture says it's okay. Our culture says you can do that without really getting hurt in the inner person. But it's not so. It's not so. And then another reason I'm so hard-nosed on it is because it's of ignorance. It is like a bomb that goes off in your hands. So sloppy standards in the area of petting generally lead to activity that was never intended. Man, I have talked to men and women countless times who have said, boy, we never expected to go this far. It was not our intent, but it happened nonetheless. The law of diminishing returns. You're never satisfied. Man, what gave you the buzz yesterday won't give you the buzz today. And what gives you the buzz today won't give you the buzz tomorrow. And you just want more and more and more. And so the safest thing is to adopt the guideline that says, hands off. I'll use an illustration of my daughter. She'd probably knock me in the head, but we lived in a part of the country, well, out east where I am now, and there was a young guy that had an interest in her. She had an interest in him, but I had a guideline that they couldn't be involved. So one day, she was at school and was due to be picked up by her brother after school, and he went at the appointed time to pick her up, and she wasn't there. He came home and told me. I said, well, son, you go back there and you look at this part of the school, because I knew where the little old cubby holes were. And I said, you'll probably find them there. And he went back there, and sure enough, he found them there. And they were playing licky face. You know, at 14, that's such a normal thing, see? So he brings him home and tells me what was going on, and so I have a little chat with my daughter. I say, now, daughter, mercy, you've now taught him that it's fun to do this, and that he can sneak around with you and engage in this kind of activity, and it really is fun, because that little guy got a buzz on right now, and he is really excited. And you want me to be friends with him, and you want me to have a relationship with him, but how in the world can I have a relationship with someone who's stealing from me? And that's what he's doing right now. He's stealing you from me. And you're letting him think it's really neat because you're egging him on. And she felt bad. She hadn't thought about that. And we never think about that at 14. Someone's got to talk to us about it at 14. Someone who's been there. So then I go out and I get the boy. He's shooting baskets in my yard because he and I always shoot baskets together. And I'm driving into the yard, and there he is, and he waves at me, you know, "Hey, Mr. Lewis, come here, boy." So he walks over to my car, you know, and rather than get in the car, he walks over to the driver's side. "Oh, no, get in over here." So he gets in, he sits over here next to me, and I'm in a VW bus then. So he's sitting over on this side, and he's just wondering what's going to happen, see. I said, "Now, so-and-so, Eric told me where he found you and my daughter." Oh, man, his face just drops. He's sicker than a dog, you know. I said, "You know how I felt when I heard that?" I said, "I wanted to come out here and I wanted to beat you severely about the head and shoulders." Oh, I just say. He says, "Now, I know how you felt when you and Amy were engaged in that activity. Because I was 14 one time. And I knew what it was like when I did just what you did when I was 14. But you know what? I went further than you did. And then I went further. And then I went further. And I got scars that I don't want you to have. That's why I say to my daughter, and I say to you, hands off. It's not because I'm such a rotten guy. I don't really think I'm all that rotten. But I would rather you not have the experiences than I have, because I got all those scars to deal with. And that's why I say, hands off. You can't lose." All right. And the other aspect of that particular thing is that it so absorbs your thought life when you get involved in it. It possesses you. That's all you can think about. "Boy, when's the next time we're going to go out so I can make out?" And it just is there all the time. Huh. All right, my next guideline, or safeguard rather, lights on. You got to keep these things simple, man. The only growing things that flourish in the dark are parasites and saprophytes. One feeds on the dead and the other feeds on the living. The kind of growing things we're interested in flourish in the light. Now, when we as human beings communicate, we communicate not only verbally but non-verbally, don't we? And so we want to be able to see one another face to face. We're not interested in that non-verbal communication that comes via Braille. My next guideline is public places. Public places. When you do sit and talk, stay where you can be seen for your own safety. Don't get this real intense communication sitting out in that VW. It's just a little too close for comfort. You know what happens as soon as she touches you or you touch her, and then, oh man, it is so hard to be objective in your communication from that point on. So stay in public where you can be seen. My next one has to do with departures. Keep them short and sweet. Don't tarry at the door because it just gets you in trouble. Just shake her hand or his hand and head on out. So some guy said, "Well, Bob, man, kisses don't mean anything. Why can't I kiss her? Why shake her hand?" Well, I said, "Well, man, if kisses don't mean anything, then men just punch her in the shoulder, you know, hit her in the back and head on out." See, because kisses do mean something, don't they? They mean a whole lot. That's why we engage in it. Yeah. All right, my next one has to do with virginity. And my emphasis here is that it is a virtue, and I would suggest that you treasure it. Hold it dearly. Seek to retain your innocence. The apostle says, "I would have you good and simple concerning that which is evil." There is no premium on being an expert. None. There's no premium on being ignorant either. But when you come to the marital bed, you do not have to come as an expert. Nor do you have to come knowing everything. You just have to come with the basic knowledge of how to get started. And yet we live in a day and age when we're persuaded that we have to have all this experience so that we can come together and so that our wedding night can be perfect. And that's baloney. How can it be perfect with two novices? It is not supposed to be perfect. The two of us come together in a marriage union committed to stay together forever, to grow over a course of years, and God has given that aspect of our relationship, which requires the most intimate form of communication, to help us come together and grow together. Now just think what it would be like with one partner coming as an expert and the other one as a novice. That's not fair. And remember that we gain our expertise by virtue of failure and learning through failure. And if you're an expert, at whose expense did you get the experience, the expertise? It's not fair. So my admonishment, my encouragement is treasure your virginity. Hold it dearly. Don't anyone persuade you that you ought to lose it. Keep it in high regard. Next one is for girls. It has to do with dress. God has put you together such that you attract us and turn us on. Now, in the animal kingdom, it's a little different. The males are generally the ones that are so pretty and attract the females. But in the family of man, it's just the opposite. God has designed you in a unique way. You do so attract us. But my suggestion would be to learn how to package it properly, such that you don't attract us just by the packaging alone. We should learn how to modestly put it together so that the guy has got to go beyond that to get into your mind. Because you only have a relationship with a mind, not a body, with a mind. And you got to get beyond the body to get into the mind to figure out how they think. But if you girls don't dress correctly, the guy never gets beyond that. And he's probably not realizing that, you know, within 20 or 30 years, your packaging starts to fall apart. I mean, you can do all the work you want. Sooner or later, it just starts to fall apart. And if you've attracted him just by virtue of the packaging, and then when it starts to fall apart, you realize, oh, I got a clown on my hand. You deserve what you get. So learn how to package it modestly. I don't mean go around in a tent. I mean, that's crazy. But learn how to be modest. All right, my next one's for the guys, and it has to do with the eyes and ears. And my encouragement is to keep your eyes above the shoulders and below the knees. Keep your eyes above the shoulders and below the knees. Job says, I've made a covenant with my eyes. How many of you have read Pilgrim's Progress? Okay. How many have read The Holy War? Okay, John Bunyan wrote that one. And in that one, it's the plot of the book is the attack of the devil on the town of man's soul. And his objective is to take over the town. Now, he knows that the only way he can get into the town is through eye gate or ear gate. It's the only way he can get in. And then to take possession. He also realizes that the only way he can get in through eye gate and ear gate is by knocking Captain Strongwill off the wall. Because eye gate is always under the control of Captain Strongwill. And ear gate is always under the control of Captain Strongwill. You are supposed to be in control of yourself. I'm supposed to be in control of myself. Captain Strongwill says, keep those eyes above the shoulders, below the knees. Captain Strongwill says, take guard of what goes into your ears. Do not allow yourself to be privy to conversations that are going to just poison your thinking with respect to this area. And there is so much garbage afloat today. Whether it's in cheap stories about the opposite sex or some of the pornographic literature that's around, the skin books or the long story books. I'll use another illustration. I get a call the other day from a school teacher. Teacher, my son, my 15-year-old. And he got caught passing a skin book up the aisle. Good night. So he and I have a little conversation in the sauna. Said to Andrew, so-and-so called me and said, you got caught passing this book up the aisle. Oh, and he gets this sick look on his face, you know. Whose was it? Oh, that wasn't mine. Didn't belong to me. I was passing up the L to my friend. All right, I can understand that. Did you look at it? Oh, no, Dad, I didn't look at it. Not me. Son, I would have. At your age, I'd have looked at that book. Andy, you mean to tell me you didn't take that thing and go like that? Well, yeah, I did, Dad. Now, you know what happened, Andrew? Those pictures that you saw turned you on, didn't they? No, they didn't, Dad. Why, are you a freak? Those kind of pictures, boy, are supposed to turn you on. And they do. There's nothing wrong in that, son. God's wired you and me together that way. But you got those images locked up here. Andrew, let me give you a principle. You cannot touch garbage without getting dirty. You can't. Now, how did you get dirty, son? You got it up here. And you know what? You're going to want to see more than just pictures. And then you're not just going to want to see the real thing. You're going to want to go further or farther and farther. It's never enough. So, make sure Captain Strongwill's in charge of those eyes and in charge of those ears for your own survival. And then the last one has to do with words. Words. Proverbs 18:13. Death and life is in the power of the tongue. When we develop a relationship, we have to bring words to it. We have to learn how to talk to one another. Proverbs 20, verse 5 says, counsel in the heart of man is like deep water, but a man of understanding will draw it out. We have to learn to speak with one another and to draw out from one another to understand what's up here. So two things. Never defraud one another with words. Don't use words on one another that tend to turn you on, because you can't satisfy that legitimately according to the Bible. So it's wrong. Secondly, you men must learn. Let me get this again. Must learn how to be tender with your tongue. Do not allow yourself the shortcut of being tender with your touch. You women, do not allow men to satisfy the need you have for tenderness with the touch. Make them learn how to use words. Because if you don't, you end up shortchanged later. It is always too easy to satisfy tenderness with the touch. But touching doesn't help that much, because we need to learn to communicate with words to get in here. And that's why words are so important. And again, that's another reason why I think have high standards, stiff standards with respect to physical contact. Well, one other thought. In terms of your conduct with one another in a dating relationship, you want to be able to look one another right smack dab in the eye and know that you've treated one another honorably. In any and every situation, you have treated one another honorably. Edgar Guest put it this way. I have to live with myself, and so I want to be fit for myself to know. I want to be able, as days go by, always to look myself straight in the eye. I don't want to stand with the setting sun and hate myself for the things I've done. I want to go out with my head erect. I want to deserve all men's respect. And so I'd suggest to you, if we would have these guidelines, they would enable us to look ourselves straight in the eye. All right, I mentioned the fact that, let me transition to courting before we run out of time. In our country, dating is really courting. And here's how our process goes. We date, court, and then we find someone we think we might want to marry, and we get engaged to determine whether or not we really do want to get married and going to go through with it, and then we marry. Now let me suggest this process. Pre-courtship dating, courtship, engagement, marriage. Dating's just fun. Courtship is the development of an intense interpersonal relationship. the objective of which is to determine whether or not I want to spend my life with that one. And then we engage, and then we marry. Now let me give you a definition of courtship. Going somewhere with someone. It's a process. Dating was an event, courtship's a process. So you say, well, Bob, when do you begin to court? When do you stop dating and begin to court? And let me suggest that there are two parameters you have to satisfy first. Number one, you have to be ready to marry before you court. If you're not ready for marriage, you do not engage in courting. And then secondly, in order to court, you have to have a potential partner. So you've got to know what you're looking for before you court. Now, when am I ready for marriage? Let's deal with that one first. When am I ready for marriage? First, I'm ready for marriage when I understand and am ready to assume the roles, routines, and responsibilities of marriage. If you don't know what marriage is about, you're not ready for marriage. And it's more than playing house. A whole lot more. And if you don't have that figured out yet, if your dad or your mom hasn't sat down with you and gone through that and had a good educational process for you, then you're not ready to court. Secondly, when you're ready to begin to embrace your responsibility in providing for a partner physically, emotionally, psychologically, and spiritually, if you're not ready to shoulder that load, then don't get involved in courting. You have to be willing to embrace that. It's part of the package. Third, you have to have a reasonable view of your life purpose before you engage in courting. For you girls, this is extremely important because the Bible teaches when you marry, you subordinate yourself to the one you marry. Now, if you have a life purpose here, and Tall, Tan, and Terrific has one over here, and you don't want to subordinate yourself to it, you shouldn't. But you need to have figured out what you want to subordinate yourself to. And then you wait until he comes into your life. I was in Virginia a few weeks ago and finished up and we were chatting and a couple of young ladies walked up and they had been born on the mission field, grown up on the mission field, and I got into a discussion with them and I asked each of them what they had in mind for their lives. What did they want to do with them? And boy, I'm telling you, just like that, those two young girls told me exactly what they wanted to do with their lives. In broad terms, not real specific things, but broad, healthy terms. And my admonition to them was, do not settle for a man who is going to give himself to less than that. I don't care how good looking he is, anything else. You wait until you find a man who wants to give his life to that. And then the last one, when you're ready to have children, as soon as you say, I do at the altar, and walk off. If you're not ready to have kids, from the moment you turn around and that guy says, I present Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so to you, then don't court. Children are the logical result of marriage, the intended result of it. In the Bible, God says, I hate divorce. And you know why? Because marriage is to emanate with godly seed. Not maybe. It is. You have no right to say no. You have a right to say how many. And you have a right to decide when. I would suggest to you that the when is probably realistically within the first year, assuming a few other parameters are satisfied. But if you're not willing for that, then don't court. So they say, well, Bob, we want to spend the first 2 or 3 years getting to know one another. And I say, well, wait then, don't get married until you're ready to have children. All right, how about a prospective partner? What are you looking for? Now, if you want to make an application out of this session, let me give you an application. And I would strongly encourage you that you do this. And that is that you individually write your mom and your dad and ask him or her what kind of a man or woman you should marry and why. What characteristics should you look for and why should you look for them? And then you hang on to that letter. And if you grew up in a situation where your grandparents were involved with you and you had a good relationship with them, write them and ask them. Same question. What kind of a woman should I marry and why? What kind of a man should I marry and why? And then always remember that you're looking for a raw material, not a finished product. I don't know how many men and women I've talked to. Boy, they've got a list of what she should look like and what he should look like. And, you know, Mary wouldn't fill it and Jesus wouldn't fill the other one hardly. So remember, you're looking for raw material. Let me say that in all probability, your mom and dad have a better idea of what kind of a partner you need than you do. Really. They know you and they have been over the ground already. You haven't. And they've got a pretty good idea what kind of a partner you need. And if your grandparents have been involved with you, you'd be well advised to ask them. And then look through the listing they give you and see what sort of points of similarity you have and come up with your little list. And now you've got a little set of parameters for a prospective partner. And then the last thing that prospective partner needs to have is a high degree of teachability. Now, how do you find that one? Where do you go looking? Well, let me say that you could embark on a course of looking for one. Aggressively search for this partner. Proverbs says, who can find a virtuous woman for her price is far above rubies? Very difficult to find one. Only God can find the one for you. You can hunt. It'll probably take God to discover her to you. Or you can decide, well, I'll just move forward in life and I won't worry about it all that much. And I'll be confident that in my progress in life, pursuing my objective, God will bring across my path that one. Or those ones, and out of those ones, I've got to pick that one. And as long as I know what I'm looking for, and when I'm ready for marriage, that one will be there. And then I can embark on this course of courting. Or I can find one in the context of what I call this pre-courtship dating. You might find one in a dating relationship. You might find one just in the context of work, where you're working. Or church, where you're attending church, and where you're involved. So long as you know what you're looking for. And you find that one. Now let's assume you found that one. You've seen her or him. Let's take the guys. You've seen her. She's also seen you. And that's part of it, that you have an interest in that one, and you know that she has an interest in you. Maybe you've dated. Maybe you haven't dated. Maybe you've worked together in the same office or whatever. But you think, you know, that one there meets the parameters I have for a prospective partner. I just might want to spend my life with that one. And you know that there's a reciprocal interest. So I would suggest to you that what you need to do is announce yourself to her and her parents, if necessary, that you want to court her. And your objective in courting her is to decide whether or not you two should marry. And then you engage in the process of courting, getting to know one another. And here's where the emphasis is on the person. In developing this relationship with the person, understanding the person, finding out all this information about the person, so that you can decide whether or not you want to marry that one. Now, not only are you worried or concerned with finding out about the person, you're wanting to find out about the family. Because always remember, you marry a family. You don't just marry a person. You marry the whole herd. And for the rest of your life with that person, you got the herd. You may not like it, but it's part of the deal. And how often do men and women just go rushing into marriage and then realize, oh, good night, what have I gotten into? And then they spend years and years in that struggle with that family. So you need to get to know the family. So you're involved in this process of getting to know one another, determining these facts about one another, backgrounds, values, philosophies, goals, etc. And it is more than just feeling-oriented. Let me use Sandy's definition of love. It's a determined act of the will that seeks the other's highest good. Love, biblical love, is will-oriented, not emotion. That's why it says, with respect to Isaac and Rebekah, they came together and they never knew one another. And it says, excuse me, he loved her. Because it's will-oriented. None of us, when we initially come together, are compatible. We make it work. And that's the way it's supposed to be. So we work on developing this relationship. Then we need to decide by faith whether or not we want to marry. And I say by faith because you can never be 100% sure. It's a faith decision. You can be 99.9%, but not 100. Then you make this declaration to one another morally, privately. You ask her to marry you, she says yes, etc., you know. And then you make it public. And it's when you make it public that I would suggest to you the engagement begins. And it just takes whatever length of time to get all the blood tests and all the licenses and make all those ash and trash, you know, things that need to be done. And then you finalize it. Now, I want to emphasize the importance of counsel during this period of courtship. That you're counseling with someone, whether that someone be your parents, both sets of parents, some pastor, some godly older person who can help you think clearly. And always remember that the courtship period is an if period. If we marry. If. And I want to emphasize that if, because I suggest that you have the same safeguards in the courtship that you do in dating, in terms of physical contact, places, etc. Now, let me ask you a question. When it comes down to the marriage itself, who is the individual that has to be taken into prime consideration? Anybody? God, the other one? How much more? Haven't hit it yet. Not yourself. Come on. No. Haven't hit it yet. Parents? Which one of the parents? Bride's mother, man. Bride's mother. You will blow it. You will blow it if you don't give supreme concern to her. Who pays the freight for it? Bride's dad, right? He's shelling out the shekels to take care of that wedding. But who's really concerned with that wedding? You bet, Mama. Who's parading the product? Mama. You better give due consideration what Mama wants. Because if you don't, you live with the grief of that decision for years. I'm not kidding you. You could say, boy, Ma, it's going to be this way. And I don't care what you want. And Ma will give in eventually. But you'll rue the day you slammed your hand down. Or maybe it's this way. Dad says, boy, I want to have booze at the reception. And you're a Christian, you say, no way. There will be no booze at my reception. Not on your life. And you make such an issue of it, you throw your body down on the floor and you rant and rave in a tantrum. And Dad gives in. Grudgingly, but he gives in. And I'll tell you, you'll pay for that one for years too. Because booze at the reception is not a big deal. It's not all that important. I talked with a young couple a while back who did just that. They made an issue of booze at the reception, hurt her dad, and then her dad died. And her mom has, to this day, has not got over that issue, that she made such a federal case over booze at the reception. Now, look, here's an easy way to solve it. Dad says, I want champagne at the reception. Fantastic, Dad. Terrific idea. Man, let's have it. But how about this? Is it all right if on the bottom of the invitation I put, you know, a little note, P.S. The bride and groom will only be at the reception for an hour and a half, at which time they depart. You know, it takes a real committed drinker to get three sheets to the wind in an hour and a half. I know. So you can let them have that booze there. It takes at least an hour and a half for everybody to go through the reception line, shake hands, tell you how neat you looked, and hug you and all that jazz. And by the time they're through the line, you're ready to leave. And you can leave, and now Mom and Dad have got that little party they want to throw, and there's no ill feelings there. Let me emphasize, be concerned about what Mom wants at that wedding. Now, some of you will probably marry when you get out of school, and you'll want the wedding here at the school. But maybe Mom wants it back home. And you'll think, oh, no, I got to get married at the school. Got to get married at the school. All my friends are there and all that, you know, and you'll make a case out of it. And Mom will probably give in. But let me say, it'd be just as easy to say, Ma, you bet. We're coming home to get married. You bet. And then you say to all your friends, by the way, we'll be back here in 3 days and we'll have a little reception here. And if your friends are that concerned about that reception, they'd show up. They might not give a royal rip about your reception. So what difference does it make to make such an issue over it? But that's usually what we do. I know. Well, let me emphasize, in terms of this process of courtship, this issue of safeguards. Do not engage in petting during your courtship. For your own good. Let's say you do engage in petting. And let's say you don't go so far, but you get involved. And then let's say you decide not to marry. And you go off and you marry someone else, and he goes off and he marries someone else. And let's say 10 years down the road, the one you marry ends up working for the one you had that relationship with. Imagine how difficult that's going to be. I would suggest you that during that courtship phase, have very high standards for yourself in terms of physical contact. Until the point where you say, we're engaged. At that point, you can then begin to allow a little romance in there. But even then, I would suggest, be very, very careful for your own good. Discipline yourself to wait. Ought not to be all that hard. Learn to control yourself and save it for the right time, for your own good. Now, one other aspect, and that has to do with this issue that the Bible says, where the wife has to submit herself to the husband. That is not a command to be obeyed until you're married. And that is, during the courtship phase, the girl does not submit herself to the guy who's courting her. She gives consideration to what he says, but he is not her boss yet. She has a boss that may be her dad or someone else. But this engagement period, I would like to say that it should probably be from 2 to 4 months. If possible, don't have long engagements. Man, when you've made this commitment to marry, those engines are going to start revving up like crazy. So keep the period short. But at least 2 to 4 months. Because during that time frame, the girl should give significant consideration to what he wants and how he wants to do it. If she doesn't, if she is unteachable, it'll probably manifest itself during that period. And if he's unteachable, a stubborn knothead who won't listen and yield, etc., he's probably unteachable, and you don't want to marry someone who's unteachable. Remember, that was number 4 in our parameters of this prospective partner. So during that period of time, you ought to be able to figure out whether he or she is unteachable. And then you marry. Well, one other thought, and let me just briefly touch on a problem, and that is, what do you do when you've had prior sexual contact? How do you handle that? Well, for the believer, he or she has 1 John 1:9. There is forgiveness, no guilt, no condemnation in Christ. That's a promise to be claimed and appropriated. How many of you remember the illustration, the parable where, when Jesus walked through the pool of Bethesda? Remember that? And all the people, it's John chapter 5, and the people were laying around, and the tradition was, whenever an angel would come and stir up the water, the first one in the water would be healed of his or her infirmity. Remember that? Alright? So Jesus is walking through the pool of Bethesda. There are sick and infirm all over, and he's stepping around them. And he comes to this one person, and he stands to the one person, and he says, and it says that he'd been laid there 38 years waiting for the moving of the water. 38 years! And what did Jesus ask that guy? That's right. Do you want to be healed? Why in the world would he ask him that? 38 years he'd laid there. It's like saying, is it Friday? Why do you think he asked him that? Because most people don't want to be healed. Most people like their infirmities. They enjoy them. 1 John 1:9 works, but most people don't want forgiveness. They enjoy going around with that burden of guilt, flogging themselves, whining. But the Bible says there's forgiveness, and there's no guilt if you want it. Now, let me also say that the Bible says the way of the transgressor is hard, and it really is. God could miraculously remove all memory from you in terms of these past associations and transgressions. But he won't, because the way of the transgressor is hard. You should not be troubled with guilt, but that memory will be there. Memory has a therapeutic value, men and women. There are things that have happened in my life that I'm ashamed of. I hang my head in shame when I think about them. But I thank God that the memory's still there. Because when the temptation comes across my path, my mind flashes back to that and I think, boy, the price tag's too high. It is way too high. It's like Jacob when he wrestled with the angel. And the angel reached down and touched him in the thigh and crippled him. And boy, for the rest of his life, Jacob could touch that thigh and he had a memory to remind him. Well, I've got some memories that remind me. So I'm glad God didn't take them away. They serve to warn me of the price tag of sin. So my point there is that if you've had prior sexual contact, that union's still there, the mystical union of 1 Corinthians 6:19. But there's forgiveness, and there's no guilt that you have to carry around. Just claim the forgiveness. Well, let me finish with that then. Now again, as I started out, a lot of this is Lewisology. And you've all got whatever you are. If you're Smith, you got Smithology or Jonesology or whatever. My plea is to just think through the things I've said, sift through the good and bad, and apply it to what you're doing. But know why you date or why you don't date, and have clear guidelines and safeguards for yourself so that you can survive, so that you can help others, and you'd be prepared when your parents. Well, let me pause right there and open up for questions to clear up any misconceptions or whatever. And I appreciate your attention. Just in general, yeah. Just to make sure that they are teachable. And it takes various issues to surface it. Sure, yeah. They're approachable and you can dialogue on things. Oh, yeah. Yes, sir. Right. Well, I had to pick something. I could have said below the belly button or something like that. My point is that, it's just the point is that the woman's anatomy, Because usually, you know, looking at a shoe doesn't turn me on. So, and that's the point. Just that we don't allow ourselves to dwell in those areas in anatomy that turn us on. Now, if you think back, there's very little I said in that presentation about physical attraction. And I wanted to say little, very little, because it is not all that important. It is important. There ought to be something about him or her that does attract you. But it ought not to be just physical attraction. For instance, I was sitting in a little, there's a Greek bar where I live, a restaurant bar, and I go in there and have coffee and think. And so I'm sitting there and writing on something, and I hear these two waitresses talking. And oh, this one girl, she's just aglow. And the girl said, How'd it go? And she says, oh, it was fantastic. She said, fantastic. It's the first time in my life I've been out with a guy that if he had asked me to marry him, I'd have married him right then. And I thought, how sad. How sad. Young lady, you are in for a store of grief if you don't start thinking. But see, there was a girl who was just turned on with the way a guy looked. And that's not enough. So you want to get beyond that. Yes, sir. Well, you know, the thing I always have to wrestle with in terms of dancing is that David danced mightily before the Lord. Yeah, well, I don't have that big a hang up with dancing personally. Now, this is just me again. We're apart. Square dancing or where there's not close, intimate physical contact. But we're coming back into the era of, you know, touch dancing, I guess that's what they call it. And it's just really difficult. I remember, and I'm a crummy dancer. It's just wretched. It's like dancing with a box almost. But I know it was just very difficult for me whenever I danced not to get revved up. I mean, it was just hard. And so for me, I just have to say, I'd back off from that kind of dancing, and I enjoy square dancing. Get groove on, it's a good exercise. Probably end up dancing in heaven. Maybe a lot better than I am right now. Yes, ma'am. Right. Oh, yeah. Right. First off, don't ask them who. Ask them what type of person. Realize it makes no difference whether your parents are believers or non-believers. Remember that your mom and dad most generally want the best for you. They want the right kind of man for you. They don't want some clod, whether he's a pagan or agnostic or whatever. They want a good man for you. They wrestle through this issue of what you might believe right now. They have a hard time with that, but they still want a good man for you. So you say, well, Mom, what kind of a man? What qualities should he have? And the same thing for you guys asking your moms about the girl you should have. And don't worry so much about whether or not they believe religiously the same thing I believe, but just what qualities of life should I look for. Yes, ma'am. Right. Well, then when you have to deal with the issue of who, then you have to decide which camp you're going to rest in. And there are two. See, and that's the way life is in the world and in the kingdom of God. There are always two camps we have to be in. There's one camp that says, obey your parents. Do exactly what they say. And you can legitimately live in that camp, and God will honor that, and God will rule in your life that way. Or you can live in the camp that says, you choose. Listen to what Mom and Dad says, and then you make the final choice in terms of the faith decision. Now, this is the way I instruct my kids. The Bible says, honor your father and mother. So I say, all right, kids, this is the way you honor me. I have a thing I call the training box. I say, when you live with me and you're economically dependent upon me, you obey me.